Chapter 20 Speaks. Now listen to mine. What's this conspiracy? Who's going to prove it? You were there to rob. You were rifling his cabin. He came upon you unawares with your hands in the drawer, and you shot him with his own revolver. You killed to steal to steal. His brother and the clerks in the office know that he took £60 with him to sea. £60 in gold in a canvas bag. He told me where they were. The coxswain of the lifeboat can swear to it that the drawers were all empty. And you are such a fool that before you're half an hour ashore you change a sovereign to pay for a drink. Listen to me. If you don't turn up day after tomorrow at George Dunbar's solicitor's to make the proper deposition as to the loss of the ship, I shall set the police on your track. Day after tomorrow. And then what do you think? That Stafford begins to tear his hair. Just so. Tugs at it with both hands without saying anything. Cleet gives a push to the table which nearly sends the fellow off his chair, tumbling inside the fender, so that he has got to catch hold of it to save himself. You know the sort of man I am, Cleet says, fiercely. I've got to a point that I don't care what happens to me. I would shoot you now for tuppence. At this the cur dodges under the table. Then Cleet goes out, and as he turns in the street you know, little fishermen's cottages, all dark, raining in torrents, to the other opens the window of the parlor, and speaks in a sort of crying voice, you low Yankee fiend, I'll pay you off someday. Cleet passes by with a damn bitter laugh, because he thinks that the fellow in a way has paid him off already, if he only knew it. My impressive ruffian drank what remained of his beer, while his black, sunken eyes looked at me over the rim. I don't quite understand this, I said. In what way? He unbent a little, and explained without too much scorn, that Captain Harry being dead, his half of the insurance money went to his wife, and her trustees of course bought consoles with it. Enough to keep her comfortable. George Dunbar's half, as Cleet feared from the first, did not prove sufficient to launch the medicine well. Other moneyed men stepped in, and these two had to go out of that business, pretty nearly shorn of everything. I am curious, I said, to learn what the motive force of this tragic affair was, I mean the patent medicine. Do you know? He named it, and I whistled respectfully. Nothing less than Parker's Lively Lumbago Pills. Enormous property. You know it. All the world knows it. Every second man, at least, on this globe of ours has tried it. Why? I cried, they missed an immense fortune. Yes, he mumbled, by the price of a revolver shot. He told me also that eventually Cleet returned to the States, passenger in a cargo boat from Albert Dock. The night before he sailed he met him wandering about the quays, and took him home for a drink. A nice chap, Cleet. We sat all night drinking grogs, till it was time for him to go on board. It was then that Cleet, unembittered but weary, told him this story, with that utterly unconscious frankness of a patent medicine man stranger to all moral standards. Cleet concluded by remarking that he had had enough of the old country. George Dunbar had turned on him too, in the end. Cleet was clearly somewhat disillusioned. As to Stafford, he died, professed loafer, in some East End hospital or other, and on his last day clamored for a parson, because his conscience worried him for killing an innocent man. Wanted somebody to tell him it was all right, growled my old ruffian, contemptuously. He told the parson that I knew this Cleet who had tried to murder him, and so the parson, he worked among the dock laborers, once spoke to me about it. That skunk of a fellow finding himself trapped yelled for mercy. Promised to be good and so on. Then he went crazy. Screamed, and threw himself about, beat his head against the bulkheads. You can guess all that, eh? Till he was exhausted. Gave up. Threw himself down, shut his eyes, and wanted to pray. So he says. Tried to think of some prayer for a quick death, he was that terrified. thought that if he had a knife or something, he would cut his throat and be done with it. Then he thinks, no, would try to cut away the wood about the lock. He had no knife in his pocket. He was weeping and calling on God to send him a tool of some kind when suddenly he thinks, axe. In most ships there is a spare emergency axe kept in the master's room in some locker or other. Up he jumps. Pitch dark. Ells at the drawers to find matches, and, groping for them, the first thing he comes upon Captain Harry's revolver. Loaded too. He goes perfectly quiet all over. Can shoot the lock to pieces. See? Saved. God's providence. There are boxes of matches too. Thinks he. I may just as well see what I am about. Strikes a light, and sees the little canvas bag tucked away at the back of the drawer. Knew at once what that was. Rams it into his pocket quick. Aha! Says he to himself. This requires more light. So he pitches a lot of paper on the floor, sets fire to it, and starts in a hurry rummaging for more valuables. Did you ever? He told that East End parson that the devil tempted him. First God's mercy, then devil's work. Turn and turn about. Any squirming skunk can talk like that. He was so busy with the drawers that the first thing he heard was a shout, great heavens. He looks up and there was the door open. Cleet had left the key in the lock, and Captain Harry holding on, well above him, very fierce in the light of the burning papers. His eyes were starting out of his head. Thieving, he thunders at him. A sailor. An officer. No. A wretch like you deserves no better than to be left here to drown. This Stafford on his deathbed told the parson that when he heard these words he went crazy again. He snatched his hand with the revolver in it out of the drawer and fired without aiming. Captain Harry fell right in with a crash like a stone on top of the burning papers, putting the blaze out. All dark. Not a sound. He listened for a bit, then dropped the revolver and scrambled out on deck like mad. The old fellow struck the table with his ponderous fist. What makes me sick is to hear these silly boatmen telling people the captain committed suicide. Pah! Captain Harry was a man that could face his maker any time up there and here below too. He wasn't the sort to slink out of life. Not he. He was a good man down to the ground. He gave me my first job as stevedore only 3 days after I got married. As the vindication of Captain Harry from the charge of suicide seemed to be his only object, I did not thank him very effusively for his material. And then it was not worth many thanks in any case. For it is too startling, even to think of such things happening in our respectable channel in full view, so to speak, of the luxurious continental traffic to Switzerland and Monte Carlo. This story to be acceptable should have been transposed to somewhere in the South Seas. But it would have been too much trouble to cook it for the consumption of magazine readers. So here it is raw, so to speak, just as it was told to me, but unfortunately robbed of the striking effect of the narrator, the most imposing old ruffian that ever followed the unromantic trade of Master Stevedore in the port of London. October 1910. The Inn of the Two Witches Affined. This tale, episode, experience, call it how you will, was related in the 50s of the last century by a man who, by his own confession, was 60 years old at the time. 60 is not a bad age unless in perspective, when no doubt it is contemplated by the majority of us with mixed feelings. It is a calm age. The game is practically over by then. And standing aside, one begins to remember with a certain vividness what a fine fellow one used to be. I have observed that, by an amiable attention of providence, most people at 60 begin to take a romantic view of themselves. Their very failures exhale a charm of peculiar potency. And indeed the hopes of the future are a fine company to live with, exquisite forms, fascinating if you like, but so to speak naked, stripped for a run. The robes of glamour are luckily the property of the immovable past which, without them, would sit, a shivery sort of thing, under the gathering shadows. I suppose it was the romanticism of growing age which set our man, to relate his experience for his own satisfaction or for the wonder of his posterity. It could not have been for his glory, because the experience was simply that of an abominable fright terror, he calls it. He would have guessed that the relation alluded to in the very first lines was in writing. This writing constitutes the find declared in the subtitle. The title itself is my own contrivance, can't call it invention, and has the merit of veracity. We will be concerned with an in here. As to the witches, that's merely a conventional expression, and we must take our man's word for it, that it fits the case. The find was made in a box of books bought in London, in a street which no longer exists, from a second-hand bookseller in the last stage of decay. As to the books themselves, they were at least 20th hand, and on inspection turned out not worth the very small sum of money I disbursed. It might have been some premonition of that fact which made me say, "But I must have the box too." The decayed bookseller assented by the careless tragic gesture of a man already doomed to extinction. A litter of loose pages at the bottom of the box excited my curiosity but faintly. The close, neat, regular handwriting was not attractive at first sight. But in one place the statement that in A.D. 1813 the writer was 22 years old caught my eye. 2 and 20 is an interesting age in which one is easily reckless and easily frightened. The faculty of reflection being weak, and the power of imagination strong. In another place the phrase, "Tea night we stood in again," arrested my languid attention, because it was a C phrase. "Let's see what it is all about," I thought, without excitement. Oh, but it was a dull-faced MS. Each line resembling every other line in their close set and regular order. It was like the drone of a monotonous voice. A treatise on sugar refining, the dreariest subject I can think of, could have been given a more lively appearance. N.A. D. 1813 I was 22 years old, he begins earnestly, and goes on with every appearance of calm, horrible industry. Don't imagine, however, that there is anything archaic in my find. Diabolic ingenuity in invention, though as old as the world, is by no means a lost art. Look at the telephones for shattering the little peace of mind given to us in this world, or at the machine guns for letting with dispatch life out of our bodies. Nowadays any blear-eyed old witch, if only strong enough, to turn an insignificant little handle could lay low 100 young men of 20 in the twinkling of an eye. If this isn't progress. Why immense. We have moved on, and so you must expect to meet here a certain naiveness of contrivance and simplicity of aim appertaining to the remote epoch. And of course no motoring tourist can hope to find such an inn anywhere now. This one, the one of the title, was situated in Spain. That much I discovered only from internal evidence, because a good many pages of that relation were missing, perhaps not a great misfortune after all. The writer seemed to have entered into a most elaborate detail of the why and wherefore of his presence on that coast, presumably the north coast of Spain. His experience has nothing to do with the sea, though. As far as I can make it out, he was an officer on board a sloop of war. There's nothing strange in that. At all stages of the long peninsular campaign, many of our men of war of the smaller kind were cruising off the north coast of Spain, as risky and disagreeable a station as can be well imagined. It looks as though that ship of his had had some special service to perform. A careful explanation of all the circumstances was to be expected from our man, only, as I've said, some of his pages, good tough paper too, were missing. Gone in covers for jampots or in wadding for the fouling pieces of his irreverent posterity. But it is to be seen clearly that communication with the shore, and even the sending of messengers in, and was part of her service, either to obtain intelligence from her, to transmit orders or advice to patriotic Spaniards, guerrilleros or secret juntas of the province. Something of the sort. All this can be only inferred from the preserved scraps of his conscientious writing. Next we come upon the panegyric of a very fine sailor, a member of the ship's company, having the rating of the captain's coxswain. He was known on board as Cuba Tom, not because he was Cuban however. He was indeed the best type of a genuine British tar of that time, and a man of war's man for years. He came by the name on account of some wonderful adventures he had in that island in his young days, adventures which were the favorite subject of the yarns he was in the habit of spinning to his shipmates of an evening on the forecastle head. He was intelligent, very strong, and of proved courage. Incidentally, we are told, so exact is our narrator, that Tom had the finest pigtail for thickness and length of any man in the Navy. This appendage, much cared for and sheathed tightly in a porpoise skin, hung halfway down his broad back to the great admiration of all beholders, and to the great envy of some. Our young officer dwells on the manly qualities of Cuba Tom with something like affection. This sort of relation between officer and man was not then very rare. A youngster on joining the service was put under the charge of a trustworthy seaman, who slung his first hammock for him, and often later on became a sort of humble friend to the junior officer. The narrator on joining the sloop had found this man on board after some years of separation. There is something touching in the warm pleasure he remembers, and records at this meeting with the professional mentor of his boyhood. We discover then that, no Spaniard being forthcoming for the service, this worthy seaman with the unique pigtail, and a very high character for courage and steadiness had been selected as messenger for one of these missions inland which have been mentioned. His preparations were not elaborate. One gloomy autumn morning the sloop ran close to a shallow cove, where a landing could be made on that iron-bound shore. A boat was lowered, and pulled in with Tom Corbin, Cuba Tom, perched in the bow, and our young man, Mr. Edgar Byrne was his name on this earth which knows him no more, sitting in the stern sheets. A few inhabitants of a hamlet, whose gray stone houses could be seen 100 yards or so up a deep ravine, had come down to the shore, and watched the approach of the boat. The two Englishmen leaped ashore. Either from dullness or astonishment, the peasants gave no greeting, and only fell back in silence. Mr. Byrne had made up his mind to see Tom Corbin started fairly on his way. He looked round at the heavy, surprised faces. "There isn't much to get out of them," he said. "Let us walk up to the village. There will be a wine shop for sure, where we may find somebody more promising to talk to, and get some information from." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.